Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. I'm one of your co-hosts here. My name is Justin Mancini, and I'm joined here by my two other co-hosts. First, let's say hello to the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com, as well as the co-host of the TV Break podcast, Alex Marcus. How you doing, Alex?
I'm ready to take a trip down memory lane today, Justin. How are you?
Oh, great. Me too. Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. This should be a lot of fun. And to join us in that fun, let's welcome, he is the co-host of the Pod on the Rooftops podcast, a Genesis podcast, along with yours truly, Noah France. Hello, Noah.
I am Memory Lane. How are you guys doing?
Oh, good. Well, that's an unexpected development.
Yeah, didn't you see me? Well, I was in the Wizard of Oz. I was the Yellow Brick Road.
Wow. Okay. That's, you know.
Those high heels hurt. Fuck you, Dorothy.
I don't remember reading that in the IMDb trivia for The Wizard of Oz, but, you know, you can miss it. I guess you can miss anything. Well, as Noah has alluded to, this is actually a very special episode because typically on this podcast, we discuss a recent movie release and then a larger topic related to that movie release. But we are actually going to be doing the second part of our 2021 in review episode where we discuss, in the first part, we discussed movies from 2021 and some of our favorites from that year. But we actually watch quite a few other things as well. So we're going to be talking about non-2021 movies. We're talking about some older classics as well as other maybe directors that we discovered. So let me kind of just run through. We have four different categories that we'll be running through today. And they are, we start off with a favorite classic film, then a favorite recent film that we think should be a classic, and by recent we define these as films that have a release date 10 years or more recent than that. And then we discuss an actor or a director we fell in love with in 2021, and then to close it out we do a best rewatch, a film that we've seen before that we watched again and that either really held up or vastly improved depending on the movie. So guys, I don't know how you guys feel about, you know, especially with there still continuing to be a pandemic, did you find that you had more time to catch up with some older movies that have been on your list or anything like that?
Well, no, I would not say really. That... I've still not been able to get back into regular movie going habits. I saw more movies last year than I did in 2020.
Nice.
Yeah, I saw far fewer movies this year than I did last year, because while the pandemic continued on, life was forced to return to a more typical schedule. So I had far less time to watch older things. And also there were more newer films to catch up on from 2022 or from 2021. So with more 2021 films on the offer, it definitely there was less time for the other stuff.
Gotcha. Yeah, I feel kind of similar. I definitely watched a bunch of things, you know, not from the year, but I really was most of the year catching up with stuff from 2020 in the early part of the year. And then later on, I was kind of like, oh, shoot, I should get to watching more 2021 stuff. So there is a smattering of stuff. And I think that there was definitely a lot of great stuff. I mean, I definitely saw some movies. Some older movies that I'm really happy that I caught up with finally. So there wasn't necessarily a shortage of things to pick from, but it did feel like, you know, there's still a lot of stuff that I need to see and hope to rectify in the coming years. But I was curious about that, just because it's like we're still in a pandemic, but at the same time, like you said, Alex, things have somewhat returned to normal. At least, you know, our work schedules are a little more fraught these days. But let's start then, and we're gonna start with our favorite classic film. And I'm gonna start with you, Noah. What was your favorite classic film that you watched in 2021?
I'm gonna pick one that we actually did a spotlight. We had a spotlight episode. I'm trying to think in how long ago it was. For one of our guest podcasts, we all went back and watched On the Waterfront. the classic Sterling Marlon Brando, and that was a classic that I had not seen before until I sat down to watch it for that episode. And that was just, that was a great experience. It's always great to go back and see. It's one of those movies where they're the lines, like, I could have been a contender. Those ones that you know, we all know by osmosis. And it's always nice when you get the chance to kind of go back to the source for something like that and see the whole context out of which that came. And, you know, quibbles that you could have with the film aside, like, for example, I think there's an argument to be made that the ending is a very, 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 very romanticized interpretation of how that type of worker boss conflict could or should end. It's very much in a lot of, and I think I had some quibbles with how the female character is handled. There's just so much great filmmaking going on there. I think the moment that still stands out to me is the moment where Marlon Brando reveals to, hang on, I'm blanking on her name, to
Eva Marie, what's the sister's? Marie Saint.
Yes.
Not Eve Saint Laurent. It's a different person.
Yes.
Fun inside joke from our episode.
Yeah. When he reveals to her that he was not the one who killed her brother, but it was basically his fault. And he very much sees it as his fault. And just the way the choice is done in terms of the editing, in terms of the use of sound in that moment, are just really fantastic. And moments like that in the film absolutely, you know, transcend the film itself and the period that it was made. And that, like, that's just all time great filmmaking right there. So that was a good experience to finally be able to cross that one off of my cinematic bucket list.
Yeah, that was definitely a rewatch for me, and I would agree. Like, I definitely would say it improved in my estimation since I had seen it. And I would also say that the thing that I really appreciated more in the second time around was just appreciating Marlon Brando's acting. And I think we spotlighted a lot of the things that we liked about it and the sort of quasi-improvisatory methods that he was using at the time, which were kind of, you know, reinventing screen acting, whether he intended to or not. But yeah, it was a lot of fun to catch up with, and it was also just a great excuse to talk to my friend Pat on our podcast. So yeah, pretty awesome.
When was it? I forget when we did that episode.
It released in the fall, I think, like November. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it wasn't that long ago.
Nope. So if people are interested in hearing more about our thoughts on that episode, you definitely go back into our archives on your podcatcher of choice and download that one for sure. Because it was a really fun discussion that we had.
But I'm curious for you, Alex, what was your favorite classic film of 2021?
So my favorite classic film of that I watched for the first time in 2021 was a film from 1962. A film that I had heard so much about that I had really I feel like it's just like an integral part of film history in a way that it is almost as interesting behind the camera as it is in front of the camera. And I was so excited to finally get a chance to actually watch it. And that's a film called Whatever Happened to B.B. Jane, starring Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, and Victor Buono. And directed by Robert Aldrich and written by Lucas Heller. The two of them also will, you might know them as the writer-director team from The Dirty Dozen, which is a very different kind of movie in some ways, and you know, maybe not in others. So this is a movie that I've obviously always been interested in because of, you know, the pairing of the two iconic actresses late in life. There's so much, you know, Hollywood lore attached to the production of this film, so much so that Ryan Murphy made a whole miniseries about the making of this movie and subsequent Oscar campaigning. Yeah, it's called Feud. It's called Feud, Betty and Joan, and it starred Jessica Lange as Joan Crawford and Susan Sarandon as Betty Davis. And it's truly
Hearts of Betty Davis.
It's really excellent. It's such a good miniseries, and I watched that before having seen this, and so that definitely piqued my interest in terms of watching it. And I'm so glad that I finally did, because it's as interesting as the behind the scenes stuff is about this movie. The film on its own just stands up as a really great film about just like toxic codependent relationships, basically, amongst siblings. And it's, like, so entertaining, and there's such great tension, and it has such a very kind of unexpectedly moving and artistic ending, if you will. You know, there's, like, a very kind of, like, art house feel to how its closing chapter. That really kind of takes you by surprise, or at least took me by surprise, especially given the time period. And it just, yeah, it's just fantastic. It's really, really good. Have either of you seen this?
No, sadly.
Yeah. And it's funny, I don't, like, it's one of those movies that I'm not quite sure is, like, I don't know if I thought of as a classic or if it was, like, just a very, like, infamous film, either because of its making or because of the subject matter. So I don't know if it's, like, it wasn't really, like, high up on my list to catch up with, but I was always aware of it, but mostly just for, like, being a vehicle for those two stars. And, you know, everything I think I'd seen about it was, like, you know, watch these two legendary actresses who didn't like each other fight and, you know, watch the sparks fly and that kind of thing. So yeah. I wonder if maybe some of the just, like, you know, buzz around it because of that has clouded the actual quality of the film itself.
Yeah, and that it's understandable, because having watched the miniseries about the making of this film, it is really, like, that is a compelling story in and of itself. Like, for instance, so this movie was nominated for 5 Oscars. It won a costume design Oscar. But the film is primarily 3 characters, right? There's a couple of ancillary characters that come in and out, but for the most part, it's just Betty as the sort of, like, as this former child star who is who's long past her glory as an actress, and is just living alone in this, or living in this giant mansion with her sister, who is Joan Crawford, who was also an actress and at a certain point in time that we see kind of in, like, an opening flashback, she's kind of, Joan is the younger, more exciting, like, fresh on the scene kind of person in Hollywood. Betty Davis's character as a former child star, she's kind of, like, past her prime, because what she was so good at doing as a child actress is just not working as an adult film star these days. But this her younger sister has so much talent and is kind of the talk of Hollywood. And then this accident.
That's certainly a dynamic that doesn't happen today.
Sure, yes. Like, I mean, it's just, like, thinking about the Fanning sisters, for instance, just right there in front of your face. So basically there's this tragic accident involving a car, where it's kind of mysterious what actually happened. But what we know for sure is that Joan Crawford's character is paralyzed from the waist down as a result. And then Betty Davis's character just kind of has her stay in her home and takes care of her. And then, like, you just jump to, like, 30 years later, or probably more like 20 years later, where you're just seeing the after effects of, like, both of these women have this, like, resentment towards the other. But, you know, Joan Crawford's character is a very kind of warm-hearted person still. Betty Davis is kind of just a shriveled up shrew in a lot of ways at this point, just very resentful and vindictive. And Victor Buono enters their life as this new person who is a little bit of a con man, a little bit of a drifter, but who really wants to make it into Hollywood and sees this aging actress as his way in, Betty Davis's character, at least. And it kind of goes from there. And so it's really this, like, three-hander of a film. And at the Oscars, Betty Davis was nominated for lead actress, and Victor Buono was nominated for supporting actress, and Joan Crawford, who ostensibly is the star of the film, and who was offered the Betty Davis role and turned it down because she didn't want to play an anti-hero. She was not nominated, and she was very, very upset about this, to the point that she basically according to the history books, actively campaigned against Betty Davis, and also arranged so that way she could accept on behalf of the eventual winner, and if the eventual winner was like one of two actresses, and she also campaigned very hard to make sure that those actresses were the top contenders. So then she actually did get to go on stage and accept for best actress on that evening.
Wow.
Yes. Very wild. Very wild. The eventual winner was Anne Bancroft.
Was it worth it?
I think she would say it was. She would definitely have said it was. But yeah, so it's easy to understand how stories like that could overtake the kind of legacy of the film as a film in and of itself, because that is just, you know, it's the sort of things that myths are made of. But the film as it's on its own really is very, very good. It's a great thriller. It would like be released by A24 today and have like moody lighting and stuff. But it like the bones of it work, and you're getting to watch these two fantastic actresses just give really, really strong performances. And yeah, and I mean, Betty Davis is it. You understand why Betty Davis was the one that got singled out, because she just, especially towards the end of the film, she just kind of just really goes for it in a way that is really impactful. But Joan Crawford's great throughout the whole thing. You know, she's got a lot of physical stuff to do involving like getting thrown from wheelchairs and crawling around on the floor and stuff. And she really kind of, it's a very unglamorous role for her, which is not something that she typically was known for doing. And she really went for it, and she's great. And I think we're so lucky that, considering how many times this film almost was not made, that they pulled it together and got it out the door, because it stands the test of time.
Yeah, well, that's good, because now I'll definitely be looking at that film in a different light than I had up until this moment.
Yeah, there's definitely like a heaping pile of misogyny that kind of like throws in that you have to sort through it with its legacy, right? Because, you know.
Oh boy.
Sure. Yeah. All right, so, well, I'm going to go to my pick for a classic film. And this was something that kind of fell outside the range of years that we had given for a favorite recent film that I think should be a classic. So I was a little bit tentative about whether this was actually going to qualify, because I think the two films that you guys have named, like, those definitely fit those qualifications to a T. And my film is a much more recent movie. And I think it has been declared a classic, but maybe not enough time has elapsed at this point for it to really get to a kind of like iconic status. Like I wouldn't say it's like a household name, but I did love it, and it was very well regarded at the time. And I think over the years has been as well. So I decided to go with it because I loved it so much. I loved it more than any other older film that I watched in 2021. And it is Rachel Getting Married, which is the 2008 film directed by Jonathan Demme. Our listeners may remember my favorite classic film that I watched in 2020 was Stop Making Sense, also directed by Jonathan Demme. I swear this was not planned. It just happened to be the case.
It was.
And yeah. So yeah, I went with Demme again. And it's really fascinating. It was fascinating for me watching this, remembering my first impressions of it, which were when it was nominated for, I think it was at least nominated for Anne Hathaway, who plays the main character Kim. And there was a lot of praise for her at the time. People were saying like, oh my gosh, we've never seen Anne Hathaway play a character like this. She's from The Princess Diaries. I remember that being a big thing. But yeah, it was
on all the newsreels at the time, they said it just like that.
Right? And I feel like because of that, I feel like a lot of the actual movie got lost. There was definitely a claim at the time, but I think in sort of the mainstream, it was mostly known for Hathaway's performance. And over the years, I just heard so much praise from it from pretty much every podcast I listened to. But also to one of my co-hosts, Alex, who was a huge fan of this and had tried to convince me many times to watch this. And what does it take for Justin to watch a film that his friends have recommended? Apparently, if it appears on a podcast, that he listens to. because
right, this Alex, was we paired, have to start coordinating more.
I'm making as many podcasts as I can to try to help out.
If you have a direct line to the Next Picture Show, which is where I heard this, they paired this with Shiva Baby. And so that's really what got me to watch it. And I'm so glad I did. This is a fantastic movie. For those who don't know, it's about a woman who has been let out of rehab to attend her sister's wedding. Her sister Rachel, played by Rosemary DeWitt, who is, I think, as fantastic as Anne Hathaway in this movie, but playing a very different character. And there's so much to love here. I think what it does for, so I'll just name a few things that really stand out to me. One is that it just really makes you believe in this world, really makes you believe in these people, all these previously established relationships. I think it nails sibling relationships incredibly well, the way that you can kind of come together after not having seen each other for a long time and sort of fall back into old rhythms. The way that there can be, you know, tension in one minute and then absolute compatibility in the next. I think this really captures very well. And I think another thing, and I was thinking about this because when you see a lot of small scale family dramas, there can be a tendency in those dramas to, especially ones that have a tragedy hanging over them, which this film does, which I won't get into for those who haven't seen it. But I think the trap that I think a lot of other movies can fall into is that tragedy kind of informs everything else. And it feels like everything is sort of follows from that. What this movie manages to do is it manages to have that tragedy and certainly be an influence on the characters. But at the same time, you really feel like a lot of these people and who they are is just a fundamental part of how their lives in general. And that a lot of the way that they are is just based on is how they would have been even if there hadn't been this tragedy. Of course it informs, you know, of course it has influence on them, but it's not the sum total of who they are. And I think that's a really hard thing to capture. And I think this film absolutely does. I mentioned DeWitt and Hathaway. I think also Bill Irwin, who plays the patriarch of the family, is phenomenal.
God, he breaks your heart.
Yeah, there's one scene in particular, which again I won't get into, but it's just amazing. There's some of these scenes just really like what Demi has to do in terms of making these shifts and sort of like the ways that characters will come together and then find ways to break apart in the same scene and make that believable is really amazing to me. And there's also this, like the cinematography, which I know a lot of people have remarked about. It's done mostly in handheld. It has this kind of, I would say, yellowish glow to it a lot of the times, which is interesting. And sometimes that makes what's happening on screen feel really crisp and bright. And other times it seems almost like this kind of sickly yellow. And it just, I think that really reflects the range of emotions that a lot of these characters are working through. As Alex mentioned, with that one scene, that is one of several scenes in this film that made me cry. Sometimes one line would make me sob. Like it was, I'm really glad that I watched this alone the first time, because I would have been a mess. But I really do think this is a movie that I want to share with people because it's such an emotional ringer of a movie, but it also feels incredibly wholehearted and empathetic the entire time. It never feels mean-spirited or anything like that. It feels so complete and everything is working together, whether it's a script from Jenny Lumet or the performances or the direction. It's just pretty remarkable, and I'm really glad that I finally caught up with it.
I'm really glad you finally caught up with it too, because it's definitely, as you said, one of my favorite movies. Also, something you didn't mention in your review, great late career performance by Deborah Winger as well, who just kind of like comes in the middle of the movie and just like steals it out from under Anne Hathaway, basically.
Yeah, one of her lines was another thing that got me, and you might know which.
She's so good. She and in such a very much like not Deborah Winger kind of like if you've watched, you know, Terms of Endearment and then you watch this movie, you're just like, oh wow, that's a lot of range.
Yeah, yeah. I have one of these days. I'm assuming you haven't seen this, Noah, right?
No, I have not.
I feel like one of these days I just have a vision of like the three of us watching this and Alex and I just watching you watching it.
Oh,
and we all just gently weep together.
Yeah.
That's sweet.
Well, if there's any people that I would feel comfortable doing that with, it's you two. So
and our audience, apparently. But yeah. Also, the diegetic use of music is really great in this mm-hmm. movie, which I think is under-discussed, but it really adds such like a cool aspect to the film.
Yeah, there's one scene which I think has been remarked upon, but I didn't realize it at the time until I read about it later, where Anne Hathaway's character is listening to like the wedding band, like basically like this whole weekend of a wedding, and there's a band that's just rehearsing outside, and they're having this, they're trying to have this very important discussion, and she's like, are they gonna just play through this? Like, and you realize, I didn't realize later until later, that apparently that was just kind of a spur of the moment thing. Like, it was kind of her being like, hey, we're filling the scene and the band is playing outside, but it works so well for what's happening in that moment in the movie. So that just kind of gives you an idea of what the filmmaking process was like for this film.
Yeah, despite being very emotional, it doesn't at all have the feel of like a studio tearjerker kind of film. And it's so like raw and alive in a way that is just, that makes it feel so special.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on, shall we? And we're going to be going a little more recent, certainly for me, not that much more recent. But we're going to be talking about favorite recent films that we think should be classics. And like I said, we tried to stick to 10 years or sooner than that. So I'll start with you this time, Alex. What is a recent film that you think should be a classic?
Yeah, so a movie that took me far too long to catch up with, that is definitely deserving of classic status, is 2012's Moonrise Kingdom, directed and written by Wes Anderson.
Yes.
Starring all of the Wes Anderson people, basically, including Bruce Willis, Bill Murray, Edward Norton, who is so, so funny in this movie and so great. Maybe like my favorite Edward Norton performance of the last 10 years is in this movie.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Frances McDormand, who plays against type in a way that is really interesting as well. Jason Schwartzman is in this. Lucas Hedges as like trying his best to be like a badass in a way that he could only be in a Wes Anderson movie. and of course Tilda Swinton is in this as Social Services. That's the name of her character.
Literally just Social Services.
Yes.
No name.
So great. And then and then of course Bob Balaban, who I will get to later in this episode. the center of this film, outside of all of the kind of coterie of Wes Anderson players, is these two really great young actors, Jared Gilman, who I now follow on Twitter, and Kara Haywood, who I haven't really gotten to see them in other things. But they're so great here as these like little like 12-year-olds just like having this sort of like, you know, like French New Wave emotional journey through this like a liberation of their souls. And it's so sweet. It's so charming. You know, Wes Anderson often gets hit for being cold and distant, and I never feel that way about his movies. I feel like he just expresses emotion differently than other people, but his emotions are expressed fully nonetheless. And I think this is a great example of that. It just has such a fantastic ensemble of performers, just really willing to be team players and just kind of like doing exactly what's asked of them and doing it at the highest level that can be asked of them. And it's also just so like transgressive and subversive. Like they kill a dog in this movie, and it's the most adorable dog.
It's pretty horrifying, actually.
Subversive for movies in general, not for Wes Anderson.
Yes, who is known to kill pets in whimsical fashion, unfortunately. I wonder if he has a hard time, like, when he tries to adopt a dog, if they're just like, nah, absolutely not. Go. But yeah, anyway, this movie is great. I mean, I think everyone knows that this movie is great. You guys sound like you both agree.
Oh, I fell for this movie the instant. Justin, didn't we see this together?
We did. It is one of my most cherished theater-going memories.
More or less cherished than Cabin in the Woods?
More, actually.
Oh, wow.
Because I like
Cabin in the Woods. We literally laughed. We literally laughed a couple of assholes out of the theater when we saw that one.
That is true. That is true, yes.
But no, I fell in love with this movie the instant I first saw it. I was like, okay, I've just seen a Stone Cold classic, and nothing has changed my opinion in the intervening years. And I agree with you, Alex. I would say there's a lot of very intense emotions going on in the movie, and everyone is trying to keep it under the surface, and they're all failing just completely.
Yes, so
it is a deeply emotional movie. Like, I mean, the for the lead characters, of course, that's central to their journey, but it's everywhere. It's in everyone. I don't know, except maybe social services, but
she's pretty emotional as well. She has very strong opinions and feelings about what should be going on.
Yeah. This was the movie that, I don't know, I guess I'm going to tip my hand here a little bit, but I may be talking a little bit more about Wes Anderson later. This movie was the one that, I think this was the first, let me think about that. It was not the first Wes Anderson movie I'd ever seen, but it was the first one I'd seen that I really loved, and where I felt like I finally understood why he was so well regarded. I think up until that point, I had been a little wary. I was like, isn't that like, you guys might laugh at this, but I remember my thought being like, isn't that the guy who makes movies for hipsters?
reputation that hasn't really changed.
Yeah, it's not untrue.
But I wonder if it was, in my mind, that was kind of a negative thing. Like, I wonder if it was a bit of an oversimplification. And I saw this and it just like really clicked for me. As you mentioned, Noah, the way that people are trying to keep things out of the surface and failing. Also, I just loved the way in which characters took themselves so seriously. That I found really hilarious. When people get, you know, when people do things that are ridiculous, that they are not aware are ridiculous, that's maybe one of the funniest things for me. And you see that going on here a lot. But also the sweetness, like you mentioned, Alex, I think the bond between Susie and Sam, as you mentioned, Kara Hayward and Jared Gilman, is just so charming and so innocent. But it also feels like exactly what they need, even if it doesn't necessarily work out as romance in the traditional sense. I think they're really fascinating characters, and I've seen Kara Hayward in one other movie where she was very good. I had kind of mixed feelings about the movie. It was a movie called To the Stars from a few years ago now. But it was really great to see her here. And the rest of the cast is just phenomenal. And I agree with you on that Ed Norton performance. That's definitely one of the ones I'm thinking of when I mention people who take themselves very seriously. And it has such a great look to it all throughout, including the... Yeah. climax of the movie on a church roof, which is just remarkable. I'm big fan of this. I actually ended up rewatching it in 2021. I can confirm it is definitely a great one. Not my favorite Wes Anderson, but it is up there.
It's not my favorite Wes Anderson either, but that's really just a testament to how many great films he's made. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, also just speaking to the cast, this was the movie that brought Lucas Hedges onto my radar, and that is just an unalloyed good. So
yeah, I didn't realize it until later. I think when Manchester by the Sea came out and I had like looked him up, I was like, wait, he was in Moonrise Kingdom? Who did he play? And then I like blew my mind when I would realize like, wait, he was the bully? What the hell?
It's so cute when he tries to be a bully. It just, you know, he does that in mid-90s also. And it's just like, I don't think this really works, but okay. Just go on another boat with a 6-year-old acting legend, please. That's what you're great at.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Well, I also, Alex, went with a 2012 movie for my pick.
Hey.
And it's maybe a little bit different, but
directed by Roland Emmerich.
I would say no. No, surprisingly, Roland Emmerich did not make it into any of my categories for this.
You're so, saving it for when Moonfall comes out. You're going to do your Roland Emmerich deep dive then.
Yes, of course. And I'll talk about how Anonymous is the greatest Shakespeare movie ever made, and all that wonderful stuff. But until then, I'm actually going with a film that I finally got a chance to see and kind of needed an excuse to watch for some reason. As our listeners may remember, on our musicals episode, we talked about the film Annette, and I mentioned that this gave me a chance to catch up with Leos Carax's previous film, Holy Motors. And that maybe that was the best thing about Annette, was that it got me to do that. And I still kind of believe that, because I think this is a phenomenal movie, and definitely made me more excited for Annette than maybe I should have been as a result. I don't know. Have either of you guys seen this one?
Nope.
Yeah, I saw Holy Motors in 2012 when it came out. It like blew me away. Yeah, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it since, and so my memory of it is not the strongest. But it made my top 10 that year. I loved it.
Okay, great. Okay, wow, I did. Okay, I wasn't sure if you had seen it or not. But yeah, this is a wild movie, guys. It's it is really crazy and crazier than I think I even ever expected. It's about a man named Oscar who is being ferried around Paris and putting on these micro performances around the city. And when I say that there is quite a range to these performances, I am not exaggerating. It's everything from motion capture, like the most bizarre motion capture session that you could ever imagine, to at one point biting someone's fingers off.
Wait, literally?
It is. Yes, literally that happens. In the world of the film, I want to be very clear about that. he's played by Denis Levant, who is phenomenal here, and the range I cannot overstate. He is throwing himself into these characters, but also what's so remarkable to me about it is, it's a movie so much about performance, and what does performance mean, and where's the line between being sincere and just kind of putting on an act. But also between this sort of artistic satisfaction that you get out of it and the more material or let's say commercial reasons for it. He appears to be part of this company called Holy Motors, of the title, and is putting on these performances. Never quite clear who the audience is or if there really even is one, which of course begs the question, well, who is he performing then? Like, who is he performing for then? And it came out in 2012, but I really feel like in some ways it anticipated a lot of the ways in which our entertainment and our art is delivered to us. I think it at times reminds me of things like Vine or TikTok even. It seems to be very prophetic in the way that it portrayed art and how it's performed and the randomness of it. There's this continuous debate within the movie of whether, like, what is he, is his heart still in it? Like, does he still enjoy doing this? And if there's no audience, what's the point of doing it? And he keeps talking about how it's in the very act of performance itself, which is a really interesting way to look at it. There are some great sequences here. I didn't mention that there's a musical section with Kylie Minogue, which is phenomenal. And I would have said, like, oh yeah, this guy would definitely make a great musical. Maybe he just needed the right material for that. but it's just something that it's completely random in some ways. Like, you really can't predict from one scene to the next what is going to happen. But yet it has this like weird through line to it. And it's the kind of art film that is, yes, obscure, and I could see people thinking that it's pretentious and trying all this like ridiculous random stuff. But it's so, it's just so fun. It's so, there's a joy and exuberance to it that even if you just, like, it's the kind of movie that I could see yourself enjoying even if you don't attempt to think about it at all. I also want to spotlight an amazing accordion sequence, which I don't think I would ever, like, I never thought I would ever say. but it is, it's kind of the intermission of this movie, and it's just this great break. Like, it, he really does, Karak does, I think, break up these sequences in a remarkable way where each of them stands out, and you don't feel like you're, it doesn't ever feel like you're going from, it doesn't feel like you're going, like, they don't bleed together at all. They really do, each of them stand out. And I think say something about what it means to act, what it means to make art, and whether there's any sort of material or even abstract value to what you're doing. And I think it's the kind of movie that is going to, like, I think it's maybe not for everyone, but I would encourage even people who are not into art films to seek it out, because it is such a, it's just such a rip-roaring good time. And I think that, you know, it's, it might be a window into other challenging films. So yeah, I really loved this, and I was, again, really good, glad to have an excuse to catch up with it.
Yeah. I, like I said, I haven't seen it now in a decade almost, but I remember really loving it as well. And the thing that stuck out to me at the time was that, yes, it is this meditation on art, but it also is very much this idea of art imitating life, and, like, art as a metaphor for life, and just, like, the way in which performance is central to how we live our lives, and just kind of literalizing that in a very specific way that only this particular writer director could. but that it makes it feel very vital to me. And there's also, at least in my memory, an incredible amount of spontaneity to the film that made it just feel like you just never knew what was going to happen next, which is definitely a feeling that I often chase in film and television. Just that idea of, like, truly the next scene could be anything, and I have no idea what to expect, and that's so exciting.
Yeah, I mean, there's, as you do develop a certain amount of comfort with thinking, like, oh, well, he's gonna, like, he'll do a scene, then he'll get into the limo, and then he'll go to the next scene, and we all will just think, like, oh, it's just him performing, like, none of it's real. But then what'll happen is he's in the limo going to the next scene, all of a sudden he'll get out and, like, just, and then basically murder someone on the street, and you're like, wait, is that another performance, or was that completely spontaneous? Like, it just, it really does keep you guessing the whole time. Yeah,
kill
yeah.
someone I don't know if it's real or not.
So yeah, it is really unpredictable, man, just an achievement.
That sounds like my kind of trip.
I think it is, Noah. Again, this would be really fun to watch with you.
And it really, it has dream logic in the way that my dreams work, which I don't know if that is, like, a lot of people talk about dream logic and it's just like, oh, it's, like, very kind of like, you know, you're floating in the sky or whatever. Mine is just like, it's, my dreams are just, they're just like a relentless series of events that just never stop and feel like there's no coherent connection to, but they just keep propulsing you forward and forward until finally you wake up. And that's what this movie felt like.
I think I'm in the same boat. That's usually how my dreams play out too.
Yeah, I like that.
Although usually the sign for me that I'm in a dream is if I try to move somewhere quickly and it feels like I'm moving through water. That's the occasion where I'm able to realize, ah, I'm dreaming now.
Well, if you want to hear more about Noah's dreams, you can check out his new podcast coming in the fourth quarter of 2022. But in the meantime,
is this a dream? Am I in hell? Am I dead?
So I'm curious, Noah, for your pick for your film that you think should be a classic, was there a kind of relentless dream logic that informed that as well, or was it something completely different?
You know. Okay, this one, I'm going to be the most recent one out of all of us, and you know, there is a dreamlike quality to this film as well. It is a movie that I have just repeatedly just bemoan the fact that it was not available here and still is not available here, but I finally managed to see it. I finally saw The Last Black Man in San Francisco, written and directed by Joe Talbot and starring Jimmy Fails and Jonathan Majors.
I think, wasn't it co-written by Jimmy Fails as well?
It says here Joe Talbot and Rob Richard. Jimmy Fails did the story, it says.
Oh, okay. That's what I'm thinking.
So, yeah. Here's how good this movie is. I was finally able to see it on an airplane flying to the States a couple months ago.
Wow.
And generally speaking, airplanes are one of the worst film viewing experiences imaginable. There's a whole bunch of people. It's a tiny screen. You've got the never-ending background hum of the airplane. It is just, it's not good film viewing circumstances, no matter what type of film. And yet, I was in tears by the end of it. That's how good this film is. It can overcome airplane conditions. It is, it feels very much like, it really does. I know you two have seen this movie way earlier than I have. I look back at my list from 2019. 2019 was an incredibly stacked year. My top four that year was Jupiter's Moon, Parasite, Portrait of a Lady in Flames, and The Lighthouse. If I'd been able to see this movie in time to have it on that list, it might have leapfrogged all of them. I'll never know now. It's not possible for me to go back in time and like redo the list with a fresh mindset, but it feels like it very much feels it feels dreamlike at times, and it feels like a sort of like a fairy tale at times as well. So the main character, Jimmy, has like this long running fantasy of reacquiring this house that used to belong to his family. And the circumstances under which they lost that house are not entirely clear. It's never fully explained, I think. You get more hints as to, you know, what led to them losing the house. But he's obsessed with reacquiring, you know, this classic, I guess, is it Victorian style?
Believe so. It's like the late 1800s era architecture. Yes.
The synopsis refers to it as a Victorian style house. So this classic house in one of the older San Francisco neighborhoods. And he has this best friend, Mont, who's just kind of pulled along on the ride of Jimmy's at first seemingly Don Quixote-esque mission to reacquire this house somewhere. And that's the basis for the film that follows. And it's just, it's so hard to try and sum up into words what everything this film manages to accomplish. The editing is amazing. The acting is phenomenal. When they're able to actually enter the house at some point, it like there's just this, the way the inside is lit and the way that, you know, you see the light coming through the old windows of this house. You know, it's like you're in a magical mansion of some sort from another world. Like it feels like they've just dropped into another dimension suddenly. You have this absolutely just stunning, stunning musical score by, I'm going to say Emil Mosseri, who apparently, this was apparently his first ever film score, looking at his discography, which is just staggering because it is just note for note, absolutely perfect. And it's, I read a few critiques of this that pointed out just how very, very situated the film is in San Francisco, which obviously I'm not from San Francisco. I can't speak to that. But it definitely feels like a movie that's very centered in the time and place that it's being set in. Man, it's just so amazing. And the part that stuck the most with me to me is the how can I want to explain this without spoiling it, so I know you guys will get what I'm talking about. So Mont is one of the subplots is Mont trying to write a play or something. He's trying to become a writer, and for most of the film it's clear that he's just not really producing anything, or he's having a hard time. And eventually he's inspired to finish the play he's working on. And we have a scene where he gets to perform the play. And the circumstances under which that happens and what he does regarding his relation regarding Jimmy and regarding his relationship to Jimmy, I think it is one of the most profound acts of love that I've ever seen in a motion picture. It is just, it is a deep and profound act of love, of him knowing, I have to do something for my friend. I have to reach him. And it might even hurt him what I have to do, but I have to do it. And the way he uses his art of, you know, creating this play to do it, it is just, it is truly a jaw-dropping scene. Although I can't even say that that is, in air quotes, the highlight for me, because there are like 10 different moments in the movie. The whole opening sequence with the preacher and when they're on the skateboard, that scene with the play, the closing sequence of the movie is immediately become one of my all-time favorite movie endings. There's like 10 different moments I could pick as like the best moment in the movie.
It's a great film, and it's one of those films that also helped just immediately launch us like an actor into like the superstrata with Jonathan Majors. Like, he just burst out onto the scene with this movie and immediately took over Hollywood in a way where you're just like, yeah, of course, because he's fantastic. Like, of course he would.
Yeah, they're both of them are just amazing.
Yeah, I went into this film, I remember I saw it back in 2019, and having heard that it was great, but not really knowing what to expect. I hadn't seen any trailers, I didn't know who was in it, so it was it just completely washed over me. And that first scene on the skateboard with them just going by all these other people who are watching that, I'm like, I've never seen anything like this. It just hit me, like, pretty much
to the white dude just staring at them.
Yeah,
with this bizarre, it's profound but also funny at the same time. It's very, very funny as well.
It also just, it captures just how freaking steep all those roads in San Francisco are. For anyone who hasn't been, I went there a few times.
I would be terrified to skate down those streets. I would die. I would literally die.
Do it at your own risk is what I would say. But yeah, it's a remarkable movie. I agree. I think Don Quixote is the right reference here. I remember when I was writing about Jonathan Majors in this film for my favorite performances of 2019, I think I recalled him as, like, you know, Sancho Panza and Jimmy Fails.
I remember you had him in that list, yeah.
Yeah, I was a big fan from the get-go. I was like, I don't know who this guy is, but he's fantastic. I can't wait to see him in many other things. And looks like I got my wish, guys. So,
yep. So there you go, guys. I've been bemoaning for years the fact that I couldn't see this movie. I finally seen it. It's not as good as I thought it would be. It was better.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
Nope.
All right. Let's move on to our third category. And this is where we talk about an actor or director that we fell in love with in 2021. And I think I'm going to start off this time, guys. I mentioned it before, so it becomes no surprise to say that Wes Anderson is the director that I fell in love with in 2021, because I decided to finally watch his entire filmography. I had seen like the back half of his stuff, but I really hadn't seen any of his early movies. So I was missing some pretty big ones, like The Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore. And so I wanted to rectify that before seeing The French Dispatch. And I'm really glad I did. I had a feeling I would probably really like be a fan of this guy, having been a fan of his recent films. But I really did feel drawn in a way that I wasn't expecting. I was surprised how much all of a sudden this was like, oh, this is like my guy. Like, he's just, you know, one of many. But and it's like I mentioned before, like, my first impressions of Wes Anderson were almost like dismissive before even seeing anything, just based on what I had heard. And I don't know if all the criticisms about him, I would say, are completely discounted, having seen all his movies now and also rewatching the ones that I had seen. But that doesn't mean it's like they do something very specific, and what they do, like, they do that specific thing very well. I wouldn't want every movie to be a Wes Anderson movie, but I'm glad when he makes a movie, it always feels authentically his. Without oversimplifying, because I could say, and there's a reason why I tried to, one of the reasons I tried to omit any other, you know, Wes Anderson movies from the other category is because I, you know, wanted to spread the wealth, because I really do think a lot of these would have made it otherwise. So without oversimplifying his entire filmography, I think one of the things that really stands out to me is how he combines comedy and melancholy so beautifully in the same movie, in the same scene, sometimes in the same line. The kind of thing where you hear it and it makes you simultaneously chuckle and kind of sob in the back of your throat. And so I think because of that, there's always this sort of emotional tension that his films are riding. And you're never quite sure where it's going to go. And yet, in spite of that, I would say none of his films to me feel, even as they tackle some pretty tough subject matter. You know, I think we mentioned Moonrise Kingdom. I think there's a lot of submerged implications of neglect and abuse in that movie. There's a lot of just general dysfunction in a lot of his other movies. But even as these films reckon with that, they never feel bleak or hopeless. There always seems to be this, while I wouldn't say like it's not the kind of thing where everything works out right, there is a level of acceptance that these characters usually come to by the end of it, which feels incredibly hopeful. It feels realistic in that it doesn't alter the way things are or the way that it can be very difficult for people to change their ways, but it does mean we can accept people for who they are and perhaps even for their limitations, which I don't know, for some reason I find that very hopeful, because it's a way to live in this world and not feel completely despairing the whole time.
I like that perspective on his movies. I think that's, I think that goes well. I think it's too easy for a lot of people do just stick with the criticism of, oh, he's just a hipster filmmaker.
Which, but you know,
there's a lot more depth there than people give him credit for.
Yeah. Also, can I just say, like, guys, his movies are so funny. Like,
oh my God, yes.
I just, and it's on every level. I mean, it's like one of the reasons I love Monty Python, for example, is because they're doing humor in so many different forms, whether it's slapstick, whether it's wordplay. And I think Wes Anderson's doing the exact same thing. He really is using the entire cinematic medium, along with his dialogue, along with his scripts, along with these cinematography, with sight gags. Like, he really is maximizing the potential for comedy in a way that is rare in the movies. Maybe Edgar Wright is, at least in terms of humor, is someone I would, you know, say is at that level. But he really is, and he knows exactly what he wants. And I, you know, I think the three of us were maybe, you know, among the biggest fans of The French Dispatch, and I read other people's reviews and I'm just like, what, like, talking about how it's not emotional at all, and think like, what movie did you watch? Like, I just am like, yeah, no, so that's, baffled that's by that.
On that point, like, I think that the reason why for a lot of people the emotionality doesn't come through is that because if you're not exactly on Wes's wavelength in the way that I think that you and I and Noah can sometimes be, it's easy to get distracted by how precise all of the filmmaking is and can feel and to feel alienated by that precision, right? Some people get excited by that level of hermetically sealed precision in filmmaking, and some people feel really alienated by it because they can't help but see the artifice of it. But I think what Wes does so well is find ways to subvert that like persnicketiness by making it humorous oftentimes, right? He's so precise, but oftentimes his preciseness is part of the joke, right? And,
yeah.
Or it leads to a joke. Like, he's constantly subverting the self-seriousness that would normally come with that precision of filmmaking. And I think that if you can access that, then it becomes a feature, not a bug. But I can understand why for some people it doesn't work as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think in his at his best, that is what he's able to do. And I won't say is everything great. I don't know if I would say that. I definitely feel like there's a range in his filmography. I think he's made several fantastic movies. I mentioned before Moonrise Kingdom is not my favorite, but it is up there. It's probably my number three. My favorites are for a while it was Rushmore, and then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, no, it's got to be Royal Tenenbaums. There's just something about the scale of that movie that just really gets to me, and just individual moments, performances. how every character feels fully realized. I'm just like, you know, that movie is ambitious and accomplishes that ambition in a way that I can just am kind of astounded by. So yeah, those are my favorites, but I have several others. There are several others that I think are like near great. The only movie of his I don't like is The Darjeeling Limited, which it seems like I'm not alone in. And I think that movie feels like it's falling prey to a lot of the criticism that he's gotten over the years more than some of the others. But he was able to right the ship pretty quickly because he did Fantastic Mr. Fox right after it. So it's all, I don't know. I really do love this filmmaker. I can't wait for his next movie. I don't think he's, you know, I don't think he's a perfect filmmaker by any stretch of the imagination, but when he is on, he is probably making some of my favorite movies of all time. So yeah, I'm really glad that I finally caught up with this, because this was a severe gap in my movie education.
Well, and so in the spirit of acting and actors and directors that we fell in love with, Wes Anderson has a, as I said earlier, a coterie of performers that he kind of that follow mm-hmm. along with him, and certain people swap in and out over time. But you're really seeing a lot of the same faces over and over again. So I'm curious if there was one performer that you really fell for in his group of performers.
Oh, that's a good question. It's interesting you say that, because I tend to think of his movies as generally being more like ensemble pieces. I don't know if there's any one that stands out to me off the top of my head. The great thing about it is sometimes he'll get someone who's never done an Anderson movie and they'll fit like completely, like they'll just like be the perfect person for that part. I'm thinking especially of Ralph Fiennes in the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Oh yeah.
You know, I don't know, like, I don't know if he's my favorite, but there's just something about the, it might just because I'm a big fan of him in general, but I really love when F. Murray Abraham shows up, and he's definitely someone who showed up later in his filmography, but mm-hmm. there's such a gravitas and a weight of years in all of his performances, whether it's Zero in Grand Budapest Hotel, or even, I'm forgetting his character from Isle of Dogs, but even that character has that same kind of weight and hard won wisdom. He's just really great at
playing. I can't say no to that guy. Oh man.
Yeah. All right. So let's go on to I'll go to you next, Noah. Did you pick an actor or a director that you fell in love with?
I went with an actress, and it's more it's not just it wasn't so much fall in love as sort of fall back in love. So I went with Carrie Ann Moss, who had kind of just had not been forefront in my mind as, you know, in terms of thinking about one of my favorite actresses. But then, you know, The Matrix Resurrections came out, which really, I think in a very important way, centralizes Trinity even more to the Matrix storyline than she had been previously, and in a way that I think was really well deserved for the character and for her performance in that role. And then, of course, I went and rewatched the first Matrix before I saw Resurrections, and I also just did my rewatch of The Matrix Reloaded as well. And that just kind of allowed me to reappreciate just how incredibly badass she is, and just how groundbreaking her performance as Trinity was at the time, and how influential that's gone on to be, you know, the shiny leather aesthetic aside, which is easily one of the most dated aspects of the original Matrix movies. But once you can get past that, that got me remembering back when I first saw Memento and how central her performance is to that movie. She's not really done. It's kind of a shame. She's not done as many like major big roles for significant films in the years in between, but I don't know, I kind of get the sense that that's kind of by choice as opposed to necessity, and when your legacy is as big as Trinity, you know, you can't really begrudge anyone for that. So it's just I got the chance this year, because of the new Matrix movie and by revisiting the old ones and remembering other classics like Memento, I just was able to really to reappreciate her abilities and what she can bring to a role, and especially what she did over previously over a couple of years, and now with this new movie over the course of several decades with, you know, the incredibly iconic character of Trinity. So that was my pick.
She's also great on Jessica Jones as a
I have heard that. Have not seen it yet, but I have heard that.
She plays the sort of like corporate, like powerful lawyer to the rich and famous, who is somewhat nefarious and not afraid to get her hands dirty herself. And she was actually, her character's name is Jerry, and was originally written for a man, and they were just like, well, let's just get Carrie Ann Moss to do this. So she did, and she's so excellent in the role that it just like would be so, it's hard to imagine anyone else doing it. She's a really great part of that first season, especially.
You know, that alone would actually get me interested in actually taking the time to watch that show. As little time as I have for TV shows.
Yeah, she gets divorced from her wife. She like sleeps with her secretary. It's like she's, and she just has such great chemistry with Kristen Ritter's Jessica Jones, and which is something that the show really banks on a lot in that first season.
Yeah, I'm with you, Noah. I rewatched the first Matrix and watched the Matrix sequels, and I maybe didn't. While I wasn't maybe as big a fan of especially Revolutions, I was a big fan of the original, and kind of liked Reloaded. But the one thing that was really consistent for me was were the actors, and Carrie Ann Moss in particular.
I have to say, doing my rewatch last night, I will go to bat for Reloaded. So anyone wants
that's
to
fair. I know Alex.
In order to reach me,
I know Alex is a big fan as well. It's funny. The other thing, like having seen those and realizing like, man, she's so good. Like but unfortunately I can't think of many other things that she's been in. The other funny thing for me was around the time when I was rewatching The Matrix and seeing her again, I started getting into the band The Hollies, and apparently learned that they have a song called Carrie Ann, which is where her name comes from, apparently, which was weird coincidence. I saw that name. I'm like, that's interesting. Carrie Ann, like Carrie Ann Moss. Like, that was my first thought when I saw the song. And then I looked it up later and it's like, oh yeah, she was named after the Holly song, according to her mom. So, she's great.
Hearing that almost makes the joke about her being named Tiffany in the Resurrections feel even more meta. Like, the explicit joke is, oh, my mother liked Breakfast at Tiffany's. That's why my name is Tiffany.
Oh, wow. I forgot about that.
I wonder if there's an interview where someone asked her if that was deliberate. I don't know. It's
probably I think that the joke is that it's like she's named after a TIFF file, which is like a coding thing. But it, there could be,
clever.
But yeah, she's fantastic, and I don't think that it often was because she chose not to be in more movies. I think that unfortunately, you know, there's not a ton of great roles for women of her age in Hollywood for the last 20 years, and it's kind of like a couple of people were able to get those parts, and she oftentimes wasn't. And if you look at her, IMDb, it's not a case where she just kind of retired. Like, she was doing some things, but they were pretty poor projects, and it feels like she was doing them because those were the things that she was offered. And it's a shame because she is a fantastic actress and she's so good in The Matrix. She's iconic in that, and she's also really great in Memento, and I would watch another two dozen neo-noirs starring her. So
I think that makes it even more appropriate in a sense that she, along with Keanu Reeves, she did get the chance to kind of come back and put another stamp on an older version of Trinity.
I feel like a lot of people at the end of Resurrections were like, she's great, that the movie should have even had more of her. So I hope that this kind of like helps her bounce into a couple more roles, because I would like to see a new Carrie Ann Moss film every year. That'd be great.
And I have to say, people, I definitely would say, having now rewatched, I haven't rewatched Revolutions yet. I will at some point. Keanu Reeves has definitely been dumped on a bit too much for his performance. But I have to say, Carrie Ann is very much the rock of the original movies in terms of what she's bringing to the screen. as is Lawrence Fishburne as well. I think he's just, he also just knows exactly what he has to do with his role.
Yeah, I think that they have, I think that Carrie Ann and Keanu have tremendous chemistry together, and I think that she is a significant reason why. You know, I think that Keanu is a good actor, and, you know, culture constantly ebbs and flows on that question, but, and we're currently in a high moment for that, and I'm sure we'll go back down at some point, but I think that she, like, you believe her when she when she shows you how much she loves Neo, and that's really all you need, and that's everything that the movie needs, all of them, to make that movie work. Every single Matrix movie is just like, does Trinity love Neo? Yes, okay, good movie. You know, like, that's basically it. So, and I feel like a lot of that is on her shoulders.
Yeah,
no arguments here. So Alex, I'm curious for you as well, did you go with an actor or a director for this one?
Well, so I had to think about it a little bit. I actually went onto my letterbox to see what actors I had watched the most this year. Mm-hmm. And it turns out this is my top three, which I think is a pretty fun thing about what my life was like over last year. The actor that I saw the most was Bob Balaban. I saw 9 of his films, and he was excellent in all 9 of them. Willem Dafoe and Tony Leung came in tied at second place with 8 films each. So that's kind of like where my headspace has been at. But I'm gonna say that I'm gonna go for a twofer, because, you know, Tony Leung's been in almost every single one of Wong Kar-wai's films, and Wong Kar-wai is the director that I fell in love with this year, because he was kind of a white whale for me in a lot of the same ways that Wes Anderson was for you, in that I had not seen any of his films, and I had been told, of course, that he is a master of cinema and that I must see it and I will be blown away, and that's very intimidating, and so it's hard to kind of just like jump on that train. But finally, you know, all of his movies came onto the Criterion Channel earlier this year, and or last year at this point. And I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm doing it this summer. I'm just going to kind of set a month aside. I'm going to watch his entire filmography. And I did. And it was incredible. It was spellbinding. It was magnificent. It was so fantastic. It was so much better than I could have expected it to be. You know, obviously, he's the director of In the Mood for Love, which is often considered one of the best films ever made. I can definitely agree. It definitely is my favorite of his films, but 2046, which is the kind of unexpected sequel to The Mood for Love, is also fantastic and excellent. Chungking Express is a film that so many people love. I liked it a lot too. I think California Dreaming is still stuck in my head because it plays in that movie so many friggin' times, but it's not a complaint. And then Fallen Angels is another movie of his that I actually like even more than Chungking Express. It's a unpopular opinion, but I you guys should watch them and see for yourself what you think. Happy Together is also a great film about kind of falling out of love with a toxic person. You know, The Grandmaster is his most recent film about, and that's like a big kind of action movie that you wouldn't necessarily expect him to be interested in, but he shoots it so incredibly. And it's a very sort of unusual structure as well that I thought was interesting. And yeah, just like even all the way down to My Blueberry Nights, which is his only English language film, which really got just savaged when it came out. I think understandably, given the fact that it was like this titan of cinema is coming to America and making a movie, it's got to be great. And then it wasn't. But I think it's honestly much better than people give it credit for. Like, it definitely doesn't work, especially not if your expectation is Wong Kar-wai, but it's an interesting kind of curio of a film with a very attractive Jude Law at the center, or well, not at the center, kind of off to the side, so to speak. Unfortunately, its fatal flaw is having Rachel Weisz give a truly terrible performance, which I just didn't know was possible. No. Yeah, but it's, you know, these things happen. But yeah, so I watched all 10 of his films, and the nearly feature length short, The Hand, which was on that that kind of three short films. I'm forgetting what the name of it was, but it was released alongside a a short film by Antonioni and a short film by Steven Soderbergh, because, you know, those are the three directors that you would imagine would be releasing something together.
Was it called Eros?
Yes, it was called Eros. That's okay. Right. But yeah, so I didn't watch their shorts, but I did watch his, because and it was okay, better than my Blueberry Nights. But yeah, overall, it's just an incredible body of work. It's just such an incredible, like, he captures emotions and feelings so strongly, it's so beautifully, so unlike anyone else. He uses cinematography in ways that just are like, that they're just spellbinding. They create these visions of emotion and like being on the edge of society and on the edge of the night and on the edge of reason. And it just, it's so great. It's so captivating. And yeah, he gets a lot of credit for being really good at showing suppression of emotion, right? Showing reserve. And he definitely does that well. But in other movies like Chungking Express and Fallen Angels, he also shows so many other emotions so powerfully, this kind of like excitement and terror and danger and lust and revenge and all of these things. He's so capable of just bringing feelings to the cinema in a way that just sounds so corny when you try to quantify it, but it's just really, it's just incredible. Like, his movies just don't look or feel like anyone else's movies. And yeah, I just I hope that we get more of them in the future, because it's been a bit of a dry spell in the last 15 years, and that's our loss, because he's just an incredible, incredible filmmaker, and I'm so glad that I finally got the chance to catch up with it.
Yeah, he's kind of a little bit of a blind spot for me, in that I have seen In Mood for Love and have yet to have the transcendent experience that I want to with it. But I think when I do watch his movies, I will be rewatching that one. And if there's one thing I can say about my experience with it, is it's one of those things where you hear, you know, I think you hear a lot about how some people, there are some purists who are kind of like, well, you know, black and white movies, you can do so many things. And I'm like, well, I don't disagree, but then we would lose things like Wong Kar-wai movies. Like, why would you want to lose that? Like, why can't it be a yes and situation?
No one uses color the way that he uses color. It just completely, like, he, and like we say things like that, but I truly he just uses so many cinematic tools that other people never even think to pick up, and it just is and it just is so fantastic to behold.
And I know, like, a filmmaker that I think the three of us are big fans of, Barry Jenkins, has cited him as a huge influence on his work.
Yeah, and you can definitely see that.
I need to
thanks. I have no doubt that both of you would really, really love pretty much almost every one of his films. With very few exceptions.
Probably.
All right, well, let's move on to our last category here, which is our favorite rewatch of a film that we'd seen before, but that we saw again and really appreciated. So this time, if it's okay, Alex, maybe I'll start with you again, if you don't mind rolling right into it.
Yeah, sure, that's fine. So my favorite rewatch was a movie from 2000, or not from 2000, from 1999, just before 2000. And it's called Election. Directed by Alexander Payne, based on a novel by Tom Perrotta, who wrote The Leftovers, which is something that I did not know the first time that I watched that movie, because The Leftovers didn't come out the first time I watched that movie. But it stars Matthew Broderick as a teacher having a bit of a midlife crisis, and Reese Witherspoon as the infamous Tracy Flick, anti-hero of high school lore, Chris Klein, in probably his best performance, and as Tracy's would-be challenger for the student body election, and Jessica Campbell as Tammy Metzler, Chris Klein's little sister, who is going through some changes, as you would. This movie, the reason why I selected it is because this is a movie that I've honestly been afraid to rewatch for a long time. Mm. I really liked it when I saw it back in high school. I probably watched it like around 2006, 2007. I was a really big fan of it. And then over the years, I just thought, like, with all of the ways in which the world has changed between then and now, would this movie hold up? Like, would this be actually kind of problematic? Like, would it be able to handle the gender politics of it and the socio-political commentary and all of that stuff? And it's all based on this kind of, like, the plight of the middle-aged man at this point in 1999, where so many films were based on the plight of the middle-aged man and in suburbia, and oftentimes those things just don't hold up the way that you might think if you revisit them. But I'm happy to say that when I watch this, it turns out this holds up fantastically. This is exactly what we're kind of what it based, like, so I don't want to give it too much credit for being prescient about the future, mm-hmm. because it's very much showing you a world that existed then, but so many aspects of that world still exists now, and I'm happy to say that it has kind of like the right opinion about everybody in its movies, mm. if there is such a thing to have, you know, like Matthew Broderick's character is creepy in the movie, and he kind of sucks, and like he is the problem, and he doesn't think so. He is our narrator. And so he oftentimes will present things in a way that then the film that Alexander Payne's camera will immediately subvert or present as not accurate. So he is not a good, reliable narrator in that regard. And that presents a lot of really humorous juxtapositions in the film that I think really benefit in hindsight and with the lens towards the future. And Tracy Flick is just a fantastic character. Like, there's a way in which she could be a sort of, like, you know, we didn't always treat, you know, difficult women well in the 90s, mm-hmm. to say the least. And I think that she is very much a difficult woman in this film. And I think that the movie, like, gets her and is sympathetic towards her and never kind of talks down to her and, like, really respects her, even when she is not always making the right choice. And it's really great. And also Jessica Campbell as Tammy is so, so fun. She's such a great kind of subversive bomb in the middle of this movie that just kind of like sets everyone's expectations on edge. And she's kind of like she comes out the best probably out of everybody. But yeah, it's a really, really fun movie. It's really fun. It feels deeply relevant to today. And I'm just so happy that it holds up.
Yeah, I saw this for the first time, believe it or not, I think in 2020, again, because of a podcast that was covering it, and just like flat out loved it for all the reasons that you said. I was surprised just how I didn't know a lot about, like, I knew some things about it going in, but I was surprised how, like, just how horribly the Matthew Broderick character comes off, and the fact that he is the center of it, which I found incredibly funny. It's probably my favorite Matthew Broderick performance, honestly. But there's just so much.
He's so good at playing he's just such a shitty person. Like, he's not a bad person. He's just so shitty, and he plays it so well.
And yet I do think, you know, like, the Tracy Flick character it's fascinating to read the different interpretations of her, because I've seen people who absolutely hate her and other people who find her really sympathetic. And I'm like, I think she's just a fascinating character to me. So I feel like that says maybe more about maybe how we see difficult women in movies than it does maybe about the character itself in some ways. But yeah, you know, Alexander Payne is someone who I really admire as a filmmaker and think is a really shitty human being, unfortunately. I don't know if you know about the stuff that's come out within the last year or so about him.
I don't know. Fill me in.
Well, let's just say he
Yeah, we could fill people? You in on Mike.
Yeah, okay. Maybe we should.
It's okay. Anyway, I have the Wikipedia page
which
open.
Makes, yeah, so I won't get into
title
it.
Title cards were enough.
But it really makes you wonder if he was watching the movies that he was making. Anyway.
I will say, like, the film was written by Alexander Payne, but it was co-written by Tamara Jenkinson's husband, Jim Taylor, who, in addition to collaborating on several Alexander Payne movies, he also wrote such things as Juliet Naked, which I think is a really great movie, and then also also I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, which is not as great of a movie, so kind of a mixed bag, but like to think that you know, maybe the person who would be married to Tamara Jenkins would be able to write a good character like Tracy Fleck. I like that. Yeah. I think that that's a and I'm just gonna, you know, forget about some other aspects of his filmography.
Yeah. So this is one that you haven't seen this one, Noah, I'm assuming?
No, I have not.
Gotcha. Man, we gotta plan a whole movie night.
Just we have to
we plan do. A
watch whole all these great
film
films.
Festival.
We do.
Yes. All right.
When we all go in for that movie theater, then that's when we'll finally be able to catch up on our favorites.
Yep. Well, the big bucks that we're making in our chosen professions. Anyway.
But that being said, film movie theaters have never been less valuable. So.
There's still time. Noah, what was your favorite rewatch in 2021?
I gotta go with the first two Matrix movies.
Okay, I should have put money on that.
Yeah, no, it was just it's one of those, I don't know, like I'm trying to think of a good analogy. Just one of those going someplace you haven't been for a while, and you get there, and you're like, oh, you know, it's just like it was then too, and it feels nice to just be here again. It was the same with, you know, rewatching the first Matrix movie in preparation for Resurrections, and I got the same feeling after I saw Resurrections when I rewatched Reloaded. I was like, man, I miss this. I miss being here, and this still holds up. I have to say something that I do think is kind of disappointing. I don't think, at least to my knowledge, and if someone has a lead on this that that can correct this, please let me know. I'm not aware of people giving nearly as much for all of the aspects of the Matrix that have been deservedly lauded over the years. I don't feel like I've seen as much love for the score, which I think is a shame because it is absolutely iconic. I love the music in this whole franchise, really, and that was one of the reasons why Resurrections is very likely to be on my top film soundtrack and scores list, which I will hopefully get to next month, because it was able, you know, it was able to revisit a lot of the same style that made the first two movies so iconic. We've already talked about Carrie Ann and Keanu Reeves and Lawrence Fishburne. It's Lawrence Fishburne's lines from the movies. They stick in your head for a reason. It's just his bearing and his delivery is just so perfect. And even I gotta say, on the whole, maybe 80 to 90% of the effects hold up just fine. Even if, you know, the trained eye can you know, tell the CGI stuff a bit more clearly than before, and, you know, as obvious as some of the green screens are, it holds up really well. You know, a lot like when we did our rewatch of the Lord of the Rings movies. And I went back and was like, you know what? Most of the CGI holds up just fine. And the moments where it gets a little gratuitous, they're there, but they don't really overshadow the rest of the movie. And yeah, and it was just fun to watch them again, too. I mean, my attraction when I saw them as a teenager was, of course, hey, look, it's live action Dragon Ball Z. And I didn't think much more about it than that. But that part is still there, too. So the little boy in me can always, always enjoy, you know, just the absolutely amazing Neo and Smith fight in the subway at the end of the first movie, or the entire highway scene. And also the precursor to that, you know, Neo fighting the goons in the Merovingian's mansion and Reloaded. And they're all just grabbing a grab bag of different bladed weapons because, you know, guns aren't going to be of any use against each other. And there's just a lot of great and even the action, even the big action scenes have great touches in them too. Like I was chatting with Alex before we did the recording, and for all the flaws with, you know, the dog pile fight between Neo and 500 Smiths and Reloaded, which granted that's probably the worst moment in that movie. Little touches like how when the one Smith converts the agent that happens to see the fight, and he morphs out of an old woman who is carrying, or maybe just, I don't forget if it was an old woman, a woman carrying her groceries, and like the groceries of course have spilled all around the ground. They just have a shot of one of the Smiths just stepping on a tomato as they move towards the fight. And so many of the fight scenes have these little moments interspersed within where they clearly took the effort to think about the environment within which the fight is happening and how they could include that in small ways into the film itself. And it's just, do you need that shot of Hugo Weaving crushing a tomato? Technically, no. But it just makes everything feel a bit more carefully crafted when you look at the whole. So everything from the small stuff like that to, you know, the large scale grandness of, you know, some of the action scenes and to some of the philosophical ideas that they're playing around with. It felt nice to rewatch both of those movies. So that's why I picked them.
So Justin, Noah and I both picked films from 1999, and you're going to complete the trilogy and pick a film from 1999 as well for yours?
Unfortunately,
American
no.
American Beauty Revolutions.
God, please no. No, I went with something more recent, and it was a film that I really wanted to watch, especially with Noah. This has been, it's been less a theme on this podcast than a mantra at this point. But it's a film that I ended up watching with a friend who I got to see at a time when we thought we could still get together with people before we knew what a variant was. And that was the film Blue Ruin, which I know I really wanted to see with Noah, especially after we had talked about Jeremy Sunier's, at this point, most recent film, Hold the Dark, on this podcast many, many moons ago. So I got to rewatch Blue Ruin. I had seen it back in 2014, not knowing anything about the filmmaker or anyone who was in it, really. And it just kind of blew me away. It was just, I mean, it was fun at the same time being like a very darkly comic sort of takedown of the revenge thriller in a way that I kept surprising me from moment to moment. I loved the way it was shot, and it really held up for me on a second viewing. I will say my friend, who I will not name, thought it was okay as I was having this, you know, just joyous experience watching it again. But in any case, I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was so, not only was it funny the second time, but I think what it made me realize is what it does so well is show this guy who is trying to basically is like hunting down this guy who he thinks killed his father, is being let out of prison, has basically made his mission to take this guy out. He is somewhat equipped for that, but not as well equipped as he should be. And I think that's a balance that the film strikes really well throughout. And as a result, it means that he'll do certain things really well and then realize he forgot to anticipate a new development, which leads to a lot of hilarity. One scene I think is really funny. He accomplishes his mission. He sees the car of the person that he killed and jabs a knife into the tire just as a way of like an extra sort of fuck you. Goes to his own car, realizes he left his keys, locked his keys in the car, and now has to drive the other car, one of which tires he's punctured for no good reason. God. So that just gives you an idea of like he is competent to some extent, but never to the extent that he really needs. And I want to be clear, this isn't just a film where you're just laughing at this guy the whole time. It's really not a mean-spirited movie in that way, but it is just real realistic about the ways that people interact and how this is not a movie and how there are all these external factors that we don't think about.
It's a movie about because how it's not a movie.
Yeah, pretty much. So
yeah, that, it sounds really kind of silly if he's when Justin says that, but having seen this movie, that is really what it is. It's like, what if you were a normal person and you decided to be like to be part of a like to start your own like revenge film? And it's like, well, sure, but like you're just a person, and that's like those are actual movies, and like lots of things happen in movies that can't happen in real life or wouldn't happen the way that you imagine them being. So he has this idea of like kind of just being like, oh, I'm just gonna be like Liam Neeson and just like go on this revenge crusade. And it's like, yeah, but like you exist in the real world, so that's not always gonna work out so well for you.
Yeah, it is definitely that, and I still would, again, would like to see at some point with Noah, you know, maybe we'll make it a double feature with Green Room if I can sit through that, because that is one intense movie. But yeah,
Which one would you watch first as a double feature?
Honestly, I might watch Green Room first because I maybe find it even more intense.
Yes, the My Neighbor Totoro.
Blue Ruin is probably an easier watch for me, dichotomy. Even though it has some pretty intense scenes. But yeah, I was really happy to rewatch that. And yeah, if you haven't seen it, I would highly recommend it.
This is our version of the My Neighbor Totoro Grave of the Fireflies question that Studio Ghibli was faced with back in the 80s.
Yeah, not quite as large of a divergence of tones. But yeah, I don't really know how to recover from that, Noah. But yeah, I've seen this movie as well, and I liked it, and I would watch it again. Macon Blair's good. He also directed a movie that's really good recently that's been getting a lot of attention thanks to Melanie Lynskey's recent resurgence in the culture called I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, right? That's the title?
That's correct.
Yeah, and that's great too. So if you take Justin's advice and watch Blue Ruin, you should check that out too, because that's also really good and a little bit more levity probably. Fantastic Melanie Lynskey performance, and Elijah Wood just kind of doing the most in a great way. So yeah, I'm a fan of Macon Blair. I hope he does something interesting next.
Yes, I agree. So guys, I don't know if there are any like closing thoughts you had either on, you know, maybe other classic films or just what you hope to see in the future, that is not current film and movies that we cover on this outside of the flashback sections.
I definitely had some honorable mentions that I wanted to include very briefly for some of our sections. So for instance, I had some runners up for like favorite classic film, including the 2000 film Best in Show, which is Christopher Guest directed that. I watched all of Christopher Guest's filmography this year just because I felt like it, and that is definitely the standout, but I enjoyed that whole experience, so he definitely also kind of is a runner-up for like directors I fell in love with. I wouldn't quite say I fell in love with him, but I enjoyed all of his films a great deal, and Best in Show is definitely the best of the best, and the ensemble that he pulls together in that one, and including Bob Balaban, is just really fantastic. John Michael Higgins, Michael McKean, Parker Posey, Jennifer Coolidge, Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, and of course, like, Fred Willard just absolutely crushes Best in Show to just like like historic comical levels. Also, I caught up with Only Yesterday, the Aisawa Takahata film, the anime film Studio Ghibli. I watched all of Takahata's films, and they were
one of us.
Very interesting experiences. I'm definitely probably more of a Miyazaki guy than a Takahata guy, as it turns out. But Only Yesterday was a really kind of spellbinding film. It was one of those movies where I was just like, yeah, that was pretty good. And then the further away from it I got, the more I was like, oh, this is actually like the most profound story I've ever experienced on film. So that was kind of a journey.
I'm kind of dying to revisit that one. It's been too long since I've seen it.
And I'd imagine it would hit different now than it did when you watched it, like, as a younger man.
Absolutely.
as a younger fellow. Also, Clock Watchers is a movie.
It wasn't that long ago.
Clock Watchers from 1997 is like a little indie movie that I'd never heard of. It popped up on the Criterion Channel, directed by Jill Sprecher, and starring Toni Collette, Parker Posey, Lisa Kudrow, Alana Ubeck, I should say, and of course Bob Balaban. I'd never heard of this movie, and it's really fantastic. And if you can check it out, you should. It's this movie, like mid-90s. Toni Collette's the star. The other women are kind of this ensemble group around her. And it's just about these like temp workers at this kind of terrible company and what that experience is like. And it's funny, but not in like a broad studio comedy kind of way, in a way that's honestly way more in line with modern sensibilities of comedy. And it kind of got overlooked in its time, but I think it would, if it came out now, I think it would be considered an instant classic. So all those movies are great. I also watched all of Elaine May's films, and the standout for me, maybe not her best film, but one that definitely surprised me the most, was Ishtar, which came out in 1987 and is a world-renowned disaster as far as its reputation goes. But I watched it and I thought it was very funny, and Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman were very good. Charles Grodin is great. I think that anybody in, like, I think that both of you would really like it. I think it's a very funny movie that has just a bizarre reputation attached to it as being terrible, and like people in 1987 just did not know what they had and didn't appreciate it. And I think it, like, everyone would really enjoy it if you watched it today.
Yeah, I'd heard that was always one of those movies that was like, isn't this considered one of the worst movies of all time? And then even before you had watched it, I had heard all this other critical chatter about it saying like, yeah, this is like really good, guys. It's just I wonder if it was just a time thing, like when it came out and all the publicity around it.
Yeah, it was like one of the most expensive movies ever made, and people watched it and were like, why would this be so expensive? And it's like, oh, sure, but like, who cares? It's really funny. Yeah. I made Justin watch like a brief clip of Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman trying to compose a song together, because they're these like two like middle-aged men who aspire to be Simon and Garfunkel but are very much do not have the skill or ability to be so.
it's like they're going in with the like the premise is we need to write a profound song, like profundity is our goal here, as opposed to writing a song and then seeing if it's profound. I wish I could say it was not a little I wish I could say it wasn't as relatable as I as it was.
I was gonna say that kind of describes my process with everything I write. Like, I'll sit down to write a review of, I don't know, Spider-Man No Way Home, and I'd be like, well, this has to be the best thing ever, otherwise why start?
Yeah, well, you know what they say. Falling in love is dangerous business.
Fools in love.
I'll just say for myself real quick, I hope to watch more old movies in this year than I did the last year, although I have a lot of 2021 movies still to catch up with, so we'll see if that happens. Some movies I didn't, maybe like some classic movies that I was also considering that I really enjoyed watching for the first time, Rosemary's Baby, which we were talking before about problematic directors, definitely a thing here, but it is prescient in a lot of ways, especially these days with everything that's going on around access to birth control in our great nation, and that was made it even scarier than I think I ever anticipated. And then also,
this isn't the Rosemary's Baby that NBC produced like 3 years ago. This is a different one.
Yes, it indeed it is. Sorry, Zoe Saldana. I'm sorry that had to be a part of your career, along with the Nina's the ill advised.
Well, you're not that sorry because you keep bringing it up. So,
but in any case, I also would give some love to Jean de Florette, a French movie that that was a pretty big deal, even in the United States when it came out in the mid 80s.
My mom really has been singing that movie's praises to me for decades, and I still have not taken the time to see it yet.
That does not surprise me at all. I'm not surprised that your mom is a big fan of it. I was a big fan of it as well. I also really loved a film from John Sayles, which was the first John Sayles movie I'd ever seen, called The Secret of Rowan Inish, a film that is, I would say, is one of the best examples of Irish magical realism outside of maybe like the cartoon saloon films, except it's all done in live action. And it's really remarkable. It still holds up, and it's just really beautiful in ways I wasn't expecting. So those are just some films that I wanted to give quick mention to.
I remember when I saw you watch that on Letterboxd, and I was like, what in the world is that? I've never in my life heard of anything close to that movie.
Yeah, I was familiar with it before. Like, I think they had done Film Spotting had talked about it in their very, very early days, because it was part of Ebert's Overlooked Film Festival. I agree with him. I think it's overlooked, and I think more people need to see it. How about for you, Noah? Any last thoughts from you?
Just I do hope to see more old and classic movies upcoming this year, but even more than that, and here's some time for some shameless self-promotion, I hope to make strides this upcoming year in terms of some new writing projects, because here comes the promotion part. My 2-year-long odyssey to remake Star Wars Episode 9 to something that's actually good is finished, ? Duel of the Fates, the epilogue, is now up on my blog. The story is finished.
Well, as one long creative journey ended, a new one began, because we have a couple of cool things coming in 2022 from our podcast friends, and that includes new podcasts. So I want to give everybody a chance quickly to talk about that before we head off into the long night. Well, I don't know where I was going with that.
Let's go with that. Yeah.
The solstice is past, Alex. This is not the right time.
So we oftentimes introduce Noah and Justin as being from Pod on the Rooftops. And guys, do you want to give an update on that podcast?
Yes. We are proud to announce the upcoming birth of Xanadu 2022.
That is not the title that we've decided on.
No one said no. That means it's the title. That's how laws work.
I have at least another one that I maybe like a little bit better, but we can discuss. We have a as yet untitled
working
podcast
title.
Dedicated.
Working title.
Yes, let's go with that. Yeah. Dedicated to the rock band Rush. We will be following them in a similar format to the way we did with Genesis, with some alterations. We're scheduled to record our first two episodes actually very shortly. But you will probably be hearing them at some point in late February. So look out for that. We will be, of course, bringing back Luke Martin as well for that, which I am very excited about. And it's really cool. And it's just an excuse to talk about music, which I love with all of my heart. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. And we hope you are as well.
Yes, and that'll be a monthly podcast on the Breakcast podcast feed. So you can, if you have not subscribed to the Breakcast, you should, because in addition to that monthly podcast that'll be over on the Breakcast, you can also find my new monthly podcast dedicated to old movies, kind of. It's called Bill versus the MCU. I am not Bill. My co-host is Bill Bodkin, Pop Break editor in chief. And each month we are going to be reviewing and talking about our reflections and memories about 3 to 4 Marvel Cinematic Universe releases. We're going in order. It's a full MCU rewatch. So our first episode is already out. You can check that out now. It's on it's on Phase 1, Part 1. So it's the first 3 films of Phase 1 of the MCU. That would be Iron Man, The Incredible Hulk, and Iron Man 2. It was a lot of fun to record, and we're going to keep doing that. So in February, we'll be talking about Thor, Captain America, the First Avenger, and of course, The Avengers. And we were going to continue all the way up until November. It's a 10-month journey to capture all of the MCU, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So if you want to hear more from all of us, definitely subscribe to the Breakcast.
Nice. Yeah. And so let's talk about where we can find some of our other work on the internet. So, Noah, let's start with you.
Well, in addition to my podcast work with these fine fellows, as well as my musical podcast with Justin, you can all check out my written stuff, including my Star Wars Episode 9 story at my blog at francenoir.blogspot.com.
Nice. And as for me, you can find my work at thecinemaverick.com. I'm also on Letterboxd at the Cinemaverick. I also should say, I have finished officially my 2020 retrospective. If you're interested in reading that, I count down my top 10 favorite films as well as my favorite performances of that year. That is officially done. Hopefully 2021 will be sooner, but who can say? How about you, Alex?
I think we can all say that it won't be done sooner, but that's okay. That's part of what we love about you.
I think that's probably a good prediction, yes.
As for me, you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow our show at Cinema Joes on Twitter and subscribe to Cinema Joes on all major podcast platforms. And yeah, that's that. I'm also the co-host of TV Break, which is part of the Pop Break TV podcast feed. So that's right. You can find my work over on three different podcast feeds nowadays. Very exciting. So subscribe to Cinema Joes, subscribe to Pop Break TV, and subscribe to the Breakcast. Pop Break TV also has a number of other podcasts from around the popbreak.com family, all about the various different stuff going on in the world of television. We just did Michael T. Ford III just did an episode of Goodbye to All That on Yellow Jackets, which is a really fun show. So if you've been watching Yellow Jackets, you should check that out. Blurred Watchers are always covering all of the nerdy goodness of TV, which has just been occupying more and more of our time these days. I'll also be appearing on Pop Break's Socially Distanced podcast next week to talk about the penultimate episode of The Book of Boba Fett, a TV show that I am not a fan of. So if you enjoy my reviews when I don't like things, definitely listen to that. yeah. And over on the Breakcast feed, we also do other stuff about movies and about music and different things like that. So you can, if you could check that out also. Until next time, when we're going to be talking about the Oscar nominations with our good friend PopBreak.com film editor, Marissa Carpico, coming back for her third annual nomination special. Yeah.
Yes, and we want to thank all of our listeners and our subscribers. Thank you so much for sticking with us. We hope that you continue to do so in 2022. But for now, this is Justin Mancini for the Cinema Joes, signing off.